Hey, it's Brooke. I just wanted to remind you that this is the second half of our interview with Anthony DePippo. And also, there's some adult language in this episode.
I don't want time, sir. I'm not a kid killer.
When we left off with part one, Anthony was telling us about his second and third trials after being wrongly convicted of raping and murdering a 12-year-old girl. He picks up where he talks about all the circumstantial evidence against the actual killer.
So the judge narrowed us down to two of the 10 victims of Howard Gombert, but we were allowed to get two of the most compelling, the 7 and 8-year-old. The judge ruled all evidence against Robert Murphy for Howard Gombert was inadmissible. But nonetheless, I have the best lawyers in the country. I had Mark Agnifilo and Mark Baker, and they represented, you know, they got Harvey Weinstein right now. They represented P. Diddy, Jay-Z, John Gotti, Plaxico Burress. Mark Agnifilo went in there pretty much in the opening argument and told him, you need your bullshit detectors on. And he did the little antenna sign. He was very animated. He was the most awesomest thing. I didn't even think I was at trial. I thought I was at a movie just watching him. I kind of like was out of my element. That was awesome. You know, he's like, well, Howard Gombert, you know, he killed another girl, Robert Murphy. Mm. And the judge was like, they were like, objection, objection. But it was already out there. And those jurors weren't stupid. They get instructions. Don't look at Facebook. Don't look at anything. They look. If they didn't look through their own phone, they looked through their kid's phone. And I want the jurors to look. Don't ever listen. If you're a juror, if you're a potential juror, if you're listening to this show, I'm going to ask you to reject any judge telling you don't look and don't do your own research. I think you should do your own research because people out there are innocent and they're hiding and they're blocking you from hearing the truth. Don't be afraid to hear from all sides. And if you got to make a judgment and the judgment is against a man who's serving a life sentence, who's possibly serving a life sentence, who's potentially facing life or death, especially death, you need to just make sure your decision is right. So I would tell any potential juror against the system, I'm not, you know, obligated one way or the other. They can't tell me. I got freedom of speech. Go on the internet. Look at Facebook. Look at the Google. You know, study. Do your research. Don't take verbatim what everybody says, because one side could be one sided and one side could be the other sided, but don't be afraid to look. And that's what I would say to every juror, every potential juror, every American.
And I agree with critical. You. I agree with you too.
Yeah.
But here goes the thing. You know, I just want to know, after the first trial, you know, you got found guilty, heartbreaking. And then the second trial, for you to get found guilty twice?
Right. I mean, they took 3 days on the second one. I didn't really have much hope after Gombert was out, but I did have a little hope. You know, at that point, I fell in love with a girl, and she was there 14 months. You know, I lost, and she had to move on with her life. And so I had to deal with kind of like two devastating losses at the same time. And that was actually the last time I cared about anybody, because I gave up on women. I gave up on love and all the other stuff. Mm. It was crushing. But you know what? I'm a beast in my heart. And DeMarco, I know you know about this. You can't give up. Your life becomes
a fight. Never give up. Never give up. So, okay, you found guilty the second time, you know. Heartbreaking, like you say, you lost, you was hurt double, you know, it's double jeopardy, basically, you know, you.
Right.
So, I just want to know, how long did it take for the third trial to come on?
4 more years.
4 more years?
It was 2 years.
And how did you spend that time? Like, where were you at?
I went to a lot of prisons. I went, you know, to 4 prisons at that point. The guards were very brutal to me. They always threatened me with death. They didn't want me to go to the yard. I had to stay in my cell. I'm a big guy, but at that point, I was partially broken. But at the same time, my stepdad hired Rockman and Associates. He had a friend that had passed away who was an attorney. And my stepdad was like, who is the best ever, and money is no option. So they said Ben Brockman. And Ben Brockman, you know, he had Dominique Strauss on, you know, he worked on all these great cases. So Ben was already following my case. So my stepdad went to see him, and he's like, listen, I can help you. And this is like a couple weeks before I lost. I can help you now. And my other lawyers were like, we don't want to run that kind of a trial. And Ben is like, you're crazy. I know what I'm doing. Let me in. And so I blew. So Ben, you know, I mean, he gave us kind of a, you know, a discounted fee, you know, other than what he would have normally charged other people because, you know, he knew I didn't do this. You know, my stepdad went to him and said, listen, but, you know, we got to get him out. So he gave me Mark Baker. Mark Baker, you know, he worked with Bruce Cutler. He did appeals with John Guy. And he was such a great guy, sweetheart. He's got four people home that have been actually innocent. And, you know, from that point, I'm doing this 4 years. You know, I was studying the law. I was practicing the law. I'm sharing my thoughts. He was getting letters from me 7-8 times a day sometimes. Sometimes I know he was getting a headache because he got less money. I mean, the money that we paid him would have been just to pay him to read the letters, not to read the appeal. But he was so open-hearted, and he's one of my favorite people today, and I love him too. And we filed the appeal, and we lost the appeal. But we carried on. And from that point, it was like Christmas 2014. Now, at the same time, I'm trying to talk to the Attorney General or the District Attorney. 2 days before Christmas, I get a letter in the mail. It said, leave granted to appeal. Now, I lost. It was a very short trip. Martin filed the appeal. At the same time, I was working with the district attorney and attorney general to vacate my conviction on a state level. So there was two appeals going at the same time. The Court of Appeals, you know, decided before the district attorney and the attorney general could get whatever they were getting together, like a 30-page brief that Howard Garber confessed that he's a piece of garbage. And it's not available online because they said names, you know, victims, and New York is, and perspective, New York is protective of victims' names. They ripped Howard Garber apart. They ripped the DA apart, and they ripped the judge apart, like a 30-page decision. And I got that decision, and within like 3 days, it was like so fast. I was in a medium. I already did all my maximum security time. I'm in a medium. I get this letter, and I find out I'm going home or I'm going back down. And within 3 days from that decision, I'm out of prison, and I'm back down third time.
What was so different about your third trial?
So the third trial, I had these awesome lawyers. Mark Ignifilo and Mark Baker. Mark Baker continued to be on the defense team. Mark Ignifilo is like Ben Brockman's soldier. Ben wanted to do the case, but he lives down here. I mean, we offered him a house to do it. He still, you know, he lives in the south side of Long Island. It would have been a 3-hour commute for him. And he's an old, you know, he's an old timer. He's been through a lot. He really wanted to do the case, and he expressed that to me. You know, it was twice that they offered me time served. And it was twice that I told them to go kick rocks. I don't want time served. I'm not a kid killer. I'm not a kid killer. So both times they came to me, and the difference about Ben, when I saw Ben, he to me, he said, listen, this is, you know, with, you know, I don't want to disrespect you, but will you be willing to take the time served? And no other lawyer said that to me before. All the lawyers were like, you know, it's my obligation, this, that, and the other thing. But he was kind of like, you know, I want to let you know. I don't want to disrespect you, but this is an option. And I said no. And I wouldn't take time, sir. They could put me in a time machine and send me back in time and give me back the 20 years. And I wouldn't do it because now I'm standing on morals and principles. I'm standing on morals and principles. And I know, DeMarco, you might feel the same way. I mean, I would love to have my time back. And they can't give me my time back. But if they, you know, you call me a pedophile. You call me a pedophile. I mean, I had to walk in prison with that tax. So I'm not happy with you. You don't deserve that respect. You don't deserve respect. You deserve for me to piss on you. And that's the truth.
And I know from experience, being in that for rape, that's, you know, that's like the hardest thing that you could be in prison. That's the most, you know, a rapist, a pedophile.
Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, you know, if they tell you, listen, DeMarco, you know, if they tell you your homie's in jail for this or that, and then you're going to look at them and you're going to be like, I don't want to fuck with you. You're a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And it's automatic, predicted. It's the same with society. In prison, it's worse. You know, people point the finger at you because they want to feel better about themselves. No, so they could kill a bodega killer. They could kill a bodega guy. And you know, forget that he's a granddad and he's got eight kids that got kids and he's a good guy. And he's just trying to make a couple of dollars. But now, oh, this guy had sex with a kid. Oh, he a piece of shit. You a piece of shit, too. You killed a man for no reason. You killed a man for no reason that he can't go, you know, his family's not going to be deprived of him. So what makes you better than me? And I didn't even do it. You know?
I have a question. Yes. The third trial, how did you feel between closing argument and between the time when the jury came back?
We had there was like three or four jury notes. There was 10 at the second trial. We had three or four jury notes and they were all bad. I was looking at Mark Agnifilo. He was the trial guy and I'm like, we're losing. And you know, he made the face, I don't know. And then I'm looking at Mark Baker and Mark Baker's got he's got a binder open and he's just writing and writing and writing and writing. And I'm looking at him and I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm writing your appeal. I'm like, that's reassuring. So the jury came back, not guilty. The judge, he looked at the victim's family. This is how I mean, within 45 seconds, I knew I was coming home before they even said it. The judge said to the victim's family, there will be no outburst. And the guards came in and they surrounded them, like that side, because, you know, it was two sides of the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
Who sits behind the DA, sits behind the defendant. They surrounded them. And the judge looked up. He didn't look at us. And at that moment, before the foreman rose, I had that feeling. This is it. Like, the whole time I'm like, they got you in a little room in the back with a toilet bowl, the little phone where you could talk to your lawyer. And I'm sitting in there for hours and hours and hours. I mean, I think it was over 2 days. It was like 5.5 hours. I'm sitting in that room. I'm like, I'm blowing. I got to think about how I'm going to prove this guy did it. I think we got a lot more in that last time. And I'm thinking about my appeal too. I came back and Jeff was in there and Jeff was crying. He was in tears. They had to give him a bag to blow in because he was so excited. The judge asked me to stand. Jury foreman stood. How you find the defendant? Rape in the first degree. You know, if they find you not guilty of rape in the first degree, there's no felony murder in New York. He's like, we find him not guilty. And so Larry Glasser, he worked the Classical Burris case. He's practically in tears. He was a piece of garbage. He sounds like a prepubescent boy. His voice is horrible. He's no match for my champion, Mark Agnifilo. I love the guy to death. He was in tears. My lawyer goes over to Argo, and he shoves my lawyer away. And, you know, I find out later, my mom used to date one of the judges, so I'm paying attention to what's forward. The judge, Judge Jimmy Reitz, he's a great guy. I like him. You know, he does a lot for, you know, drug addicts. He tries to create a program where they can, you know, get rehabilitated. He's looking at my mom, giving her the thumbs up. And I don't know this. My mom did this later. And so she kind of knew. I knew. And then I came home and it was all TV cameras. And we had a good dinner. Jeff came to dinner and we're sitting there. And
did you go home the same day that they came back not guilty?
Yeah. Well, they made me go back to the jail because they wanted to, you know, make sure I didn't have any other, you know, warrants or whatever. So I had to go to jail for another 45, 50 minutes. I was there. I didn't mind. I wanted to walk out the courthouse, but they didn't allow that. You know, I had to go through the process or whatever. I think that was bullshit, but I did it anyway. And the TV was there, and I came out, and Jeff was there, and my family, Andy's sisters were there, and Andy's dad, who was still wrongfully convicted because they're pieces of garbage. They came, and
How did you feel, though? How did you feel to finally be acquitted after all those years? What were some of the thoughts that's going through your head?
I was kind of just enthralled in the moment. I didn't really have any thoughts of what was going on. It was just that, you know, I wanted everybody else to be happy. And I really didn't think for myself. And I remember I went to the Red Lobster, and this was really awesome. I'm going to share this small story with you. I'm sitting in the Red Lobster with Andy's sisters, my stepdad, my mom. My stepdad's my savior. He spent so much money trying to get me out of prison. Jeff is there. My sister, who I never met before, is there. And we're hanging out. And so one of the guards that was taking me back and forth to the first trial comes up and shakes my hand. He's like, Anthony, you remember me? And, you know, obviously I met a lot of people in my life, so automatically I'm not really too sure. He's like, I'm Officer Sanzarelli. I was taking you back and forth to the first trial. I thought things were bad back then, but I want to congratulate you. And, let me get you a beer. So he gave me a big full Blue Moon. And I thought that was special. This kid was having a birthday. I thought that was special.
Andrew is still incarcerated. You were released. So what's preventing him from having the same release?
All right. Oh, let's go into Andy. And this is kind of critical. Andy signed a false statement. Confession with Daniel Stevens, the same guy that, you know, convinced Jeffrey Deskovic to sign his false statement, a false confession through the use of his lie detector equipment, and the largest award ever in the history of America was awarded to Jeffrey Deskovic, which is like $41 million. And he went to a 10-3 or a 10-6. You know, if he lost, he was going to get 6. If he won, he was going to get 10 against Dan Stevens. But the jury came back with the largest ever in the history of America, $41 million, because this guy, you know, had him confess a crime he didn't commit. So Andy had signed this false confession, and that's the difference. That's why our trials were separated, because they can't use his statement against me unless he testifies. And they asked him. At the first trial, they said, listen, testify against Anthony, and we'll give you a lesser sentence. It's like, no, you tricked me into saying that. I'm not doing that. It's all BS. And at the last trial, the DA came to him, listen, we're going to let you out. All you got to do is say Anthony did it. And again, to his credit, and a lot of people might have, said, hell with it. I'm just going to do it. He'd rather do his time that they gave him that he shouldn't be doing. That's really Howard Dahmer's time, rather than to falsely blame me for something I didn't do. And so, I think that's a big part. And we didn't really touch on that. I think that's a big part of this story. Right now, he's on appeal. He was granted leave to appeal. The same judge that saw me acquitted denied his motion to vacate his judgment. But the appellate division, second department here in New York, which is pretty good. It's not the best, but, no court is the best. But it does, the best it can. It's given him an opportunity to have his appeal heard, which is, you have to ask permission. And so he's got the Innocence Network, which is like all the Innocence Project filing, what is it called? Amicus curiae? Amicus brief. Friend of the court. He's represented by both Jeffrey Deskovic, who isn't practicing law yet, but Adele Bernard, who is married to Peter Neufeld, co-founder of the Innocence Project. I recently talked to Marty Tankliff, you guys are very fond of. Yeah, and Marty said he would be willing to get involved. So I'm trying to, assemble a team, because It's going to happen. You know, why am I home? I'm a member of the National Registry of Exonerations, and Andy's still in prison. So the court's going to have a hard time just with that fact.
Let alone.
The issue is, yeah, the issue is, though, you know, the only thing that's holding him in prison is that false confession, who, you know, we the largest settlement against in the country against Danny Stevens is the same guy that, you know, that took Jeff's false confession. So the court's got to deal with that. And also, you know, Andy deserves an opportunity like I have to present proof against Howard Gombert, you know, both under an actual innocence theory and newly discovered evidence. And that's also hard to overcome. And the judge in my last trial, he blocked some of the evidence. He couldn't block it all. But really, in theory, the jury should have heard about Robert Murphy. I mean, that is highly compelling. You know, it's important circumstances independent of, you know, Howard Gombert's statements to Joe Santoro itself to attest to his trustworthiness and reliability. I mean, you can't, I mean, that is an incredible, that is like ultimate proof. This guy is the guy. I would swear to God, I would bow down before the Lord Jesus Christ if he walked to me today and said, what happened here? And Howard Gombert killed this girl. I risk everybody I love and all the chances I have in entering the kingdom of heaven. This is the man. And you know what? I would be right and I would go to heaven. Oh, well, I would go to heaven if not for some of the other things maybe I might have did in my life. But I would go to heaven just on that alone. And Jesus would know that I am not lying to him. And so that's how strong, and I don't know how to say, how to affirm anything other than that. I am actually innocent. I am home, and I'm thankful. I'm blessed every day, but I'm hurt. I'm hurt. Because, you know, other people, not only Andy, other people are still there, and I don't think I'm ever going to be able to rest at night. Knowing that people, that DA are doing this all across the country. That's why I work with people, and I try to do the work.
So the actual culprit who committed the crime that you were wrongly convicted of, where is he at?
He's in Connecticut serving 30 years for raping an 8-year-old girl in the woods.
Where is he ever charged with this crime?
No, they won't charge him, because if they charge him with this crime, then they would have to let Andy go. And even if they charge him with Robert Murphy in the same county, because it's all in Putnam County, they would essentially be admitting that, you know, we were right all along and that Andy is innocent and that I was innocent. And they're not willing to go that route.
Yeah, I think it that much.
I barked that tree. And listen, and I'm contemplating a new letter to the DA. Listen, this time, you know, let's work together. Here's another olive branch. And every time I speak to the public, and either my case or other cases, because they're framing other people upon them. They did my man Anthony Grigor off dirty with the false confession. He just got reconvicted for his second trial. I was there with his family at the whole time watching that trial. I don't like this. This is not good. This is not good. This is not good. You know, we as a society must be better. And we must assure that our innocent people coming home. Forget that they're getting sued. Forget that somebody's election is at stake. Fuck their election. These people, they're living in their nice houses, and they're eating lobster, and they're sleeping with their wives, while innocent men have to live behind a 6x9. Just because they don't want to be honest. Listen, I will respect you. Ken Thompson, we were just with Ken Thompson's wife. Ken Thompson, you know, he supported 22 or 23 wrongful convictions. He's got a conviction review bureau here in Brooklyn. Unfortunately, he passed away. He's a champion of justice. He is the role model that all prosecutors should follow, but they don't. And the reason why they don't is because, you know, you have, you know, cops, they're all in bed together. They, you know, they want to protect the cops. They want to make sure the election's right. They never want to admit wrong. It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. Listen, the system is messed up. McDonald's, 351 people wrongfully convicted, DNA evidence proved beyond certainty they were innocent.
Sad.
You know Derek Jameson. You know Derek Jameson. He's God bless everybody every day. Without 31 pieces or 35 pieces of evidence wrong, that fraud. he was sentenced to death. They said, you're going to die for this. And he didn't even do it. And he didn't do it. And he's not the only one. They put to death a 14-year-old kid. You want to talk about America, and this is the greatest place on earth. I'm not so sure about that. I'm not so sure about it.
So let me ask you this. How do you think that your experience has changed your outlook on life? You know, what you've been through the courts, wrongly convicted, everything. How has that changed your outlook on life?
I got a heightened awareness of the dirtiness the cops are doing, the DAs do. I always considered myself a good dude. When I was a kid, I lived by the corner of the street. You know, now I'm home. My outlook on life is like this. Like, I'm not just happy that I'm home. Even when I get Andy home, or we get Andy home, I'm not going to be happy. As long as there's work to be done, I'm going to have to do the work. And so I don't think I'll ever rest. I don't think I'll ever rest until, you know, and even, you know, even when DAs start to admit, you know, this is the best practice to ensure justice is done rather than secure the conviction, there's always going to be somebody somewhere that needs help. And I really wish I had it into me to go to law school. I know my lawyers would love for me to go to law school. They're always urging me, saying, don't, you know, lose your talent. You're an excellent writer. You're excellent, you know, speaking, and you're passionate. I'm 42. But, you know, I mean, I could still do the work, you know, an investigative function and go out and knock on doors and say, listen, you gave a statement to the police. I don't think that, you know, that statement, I think something happened wrong. That's the work I want to do. And so I'm trying to go to that angle. And I don't think I'll ever rest, really.
So you were exonerated in 2016. What does your life look like now? Like,
well, the purpose of my life, I mean, you're asking like four questions. The purpose of my life, I think, really is to give back, like to try to help the next person, like DeMarco and other people, and whatever function I can to help the next person. You know, I'm not living the greatest. Reintegration is very hard. They give a lot of, things to people who are guilty. They give them housing, Medicaid, all these things. They're not available for the actually innocent or the exonerated. So when I came home, I had to, you know, jump through hurdles just to get to where I'm at. And I'm still not really where I'm at. I don't even know where I'm at. Really, I mean, I would like to have a full-time job. I don't make no money. I'm not working. I'm in therapy. I'm not entirely there mentally, but I know that I have this passion and I want to live a good life and I want to be a part of society. But once you've been through that, I kind of identify with the end of the Lord of the Rings. I don't know if you've seen the Lord of the Rings. You know, the Hobbits was Frodo. You know, he wore the ring for so long, and at the end he was with his friends and he said, you know, I had to hug his friends goodbye. He said, I got to go with them too. You know, he had to get on the boat with the wizards and the fairies and this and that and the other thing. And they're like, why? You don't have to leave. You're our friend. You can stay. He's like, what? Well, you know, he had the ring for too long. And I feel kind of like that guy. I feel like I had the ring for too long. And I don't really feel like I'm the same person and that, you know, that I can just jump into society. Everybody's got lives. They grew up. I'm looking at people. There's, you know, people that I was kids with are now got full silver and gray hair. And, you know, they got restaurants and bars and, or they're doing, you know, the construction and doing, you know, life. And, you know, what do you tell a guy after he did 42 years? How do you rejoin society? And that's a huge, huge thing for us as exonerees. Let alone everybody that's been through prison. How do you rejoin society? And I still haven't found that out.
It's hard.
It is.
It's hard.
I mean, we got to do the best we can. And, you know, I have a lot of hope. And I really want to you know, be somebody. I just haven't figured it out, man. So that's pretty much the most difficult thing, is like finding myself. But, you know, I feel passionate about the innocence movement. I feel passionate about helping the next person. And sometimes I will go out on a limb and give what I got before I have to make sure the next person is all right. And that's pretty much my, you know, what I'm doing.
When we talked with Anthony, he's a very straight up person, and I like his passion and the way that he wants to help the cause. What did you think about the interview?
He was very passionate. You know, at times he couldn't contain himself, and he, you know, he spoke how he felt.
Right, exactly. And I think he has big things ahead of him. I think he's going to do amazing things.
I wish him the best.
So, until next time, until next year, thank you so much for listening.
Merry Christmas.